no end of possible explanations.
I don't think that can be a good thing. I remember someone once complained to me about astrology. They didn't like astrology, didn't believe in it, because there wasn't even a theory for why astrology works. I'm like,
oh, really?
That's your problem? I'll give you a theory. I'll just make one up. So I did, and they were very happy with it.
Oh, wow. Well, actually, like, once you got a bit of an idea of the nature, the what ether is, then it becomes pretty obvious how astrology works. But I guess a lot of people don't really have those kinds of conceptualizations. They think, and they have bought into things like relativity and stuff like that, which, and you know, gravity.
Well, relativity and gravity are not wrong, they're just not enough.
Yeah, I mean, relativity has a place, but it's but although the version of relativity that it should be is not the Einsteinian version, but there is a version of relativity there's an earlier version that should be applied that Einstein basically stole. There's an earlier version, but it takes into account the ether, and it's way more complicated than Einstein's, you know, really nice, simple equations. Which is the reason why everybody loves Einstein, is because he's got nice simple equations, and you know, they're not hard to understand, and they don't have lots of terms.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're not accounting for lots and lots of different things all at the same time. So, you know, because he goes, well, you know, speed of light is constant. So, which it isn't. Speed of light isn't constant, but he goes, in a vacuum, it's not constant. But he goes, oh, you know, speed of light is a constant. So blah, 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 blah. And so that, you know, so it allows him to do massive simplifications, right? Whereas when there's ether, you can't do that stuff. And so you have to revert back to the earlier version of relativity, which he did a very simplified version of, which Sagnac proved in 1912. He basically did another version of the Michelson-Morley experiment from 1871, and he set up the frame of reference differently. So the frame of reference, instead of being a 90 degree, two orthogonal beams of light, you know, zooming out and in orthogonal directions, and then, you know, coming and then returning along those same axes. Instead of doing that, if you do it that way, then you're assuming for your frame of reference a rigid and rectilinear, or at least linear, ether.
Mm-hmm.
Best way to think about it is a rigid and uniform ether. Whereas the ether, as it has always been described by the ancients, was never uniform and was never rigid. And in fact, you need to use a circular or spherical frame of reference, because everything, or at the very least conical, because at the very least everything is turning.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that your ether is also turning as the planet turns, as the sun turns, as the planet goes around, you know, as the planet makes a path relative to the sun and the other planets and so on. So you've got to set up your frame of reference correctly. So what he did is he set up a frame of reference that was circular, and he had the beam of light go out in one direction, and circle around and circle back to its point of origin using prisms. And then he had another beam of light set off at exactly the same time, and zoom out in the opposite direction and come around exactly the same circle using the same prisms. And what he discovered was that indeed there is a change in there is a change in the speed of light as the light moves. So the
this is fascinating stuff. I want to get you in a conversation with a physicist who can actually comment on it, because I have no idea. I mean, I did physics 101 in university and failed relativity because it was cool, but I could never get the maths right. So if it's even more complicated, it's a little bit beyond me.
Well, it's complicated, but it's not. It actually makes more sense. You know, the notion that the speed of light is constant everywhere,
as far as I'm concerned, relativity doesn't make sense. That's one of the reasons it's so cool.
I used to feel that same way, actually. I used to like that about it too. I used to like that sort of paradoxical, all those nice paradoxes and stuff. But it always used to annoy me that you couldn't travel faster than light.
Mm-hmm.
That always seemed to me to be, there was something wrong with that. I couldn't figure out what it was that was wrong with it. But there always seemed to be something wrong. There always felt like there was something wrong about that. And I thought, to myself, oh, well, you know, I guess that's just the way it is, right? But the more you look at the paradoxes and the more you look into these, like this idea that you can have infinite mass and you can have these kinds of things, and even the notion of time as a dimension in space, as a dimension, like space is a dimension. All these things are not right. They're incorrect. They're bad mixings, basically. And one of the reasons why you end up with one of the reasons why one of the 10 dimensions is stochastic. It's a dimension of chance, or it's a dimension of probability. It's a probability dimension. It has to do with the way that light breaks itself up when you put it through, you know, the double slit experiment. Double slit.
Yeah.
So they had to. They've resorted to using, because of this bad mixing. They've resorted to using a probability dimension. You don't need a probability dimension if you don't have bad mixing. So the whole reason for the invention of probability is because people were not able to distinguish out the correct variables. So they invented a variable that they called the random variable. So they invented a variable called the random variable. And that sort of lets you get away with all kinds of stuff. You know, you can pretty much, we can do everything in terms of probability. And that way we don't have to worry about, we don't have to worry about finding out what the real variables are. And we can just have these error terms that just, you know, the error terms are probabilistic, and our conclusions are probabilistic. And then you have these, you know, stochastic differential equations that you end up with in this system, or these systems. Eventually you end up with these systems of stochastic differential equations. And it's really, it's not what you're supposed to do. It's a fudge, you know, like it's you there. So, and part of the problem is that all of the Einsteinian dimensions beyond three. So time and all of the other ones that go up to 10, they're all dimensions that are really just extensions of three dimensions. In other words, you're standing in three dimensions and you're looking out at these 10, at how do you explain these other things? And you say, okay, well, there's this dimension and this dimension, this dimension, this dimension. And so you end up with your 10 dimensions. But the problem is they're all really based on your viewpoint as standing in three dimensions. So you haven't really considered what would it be like to have a fourth spatial dimension? What would that, what sort of what kinds of things would suddenly disappear from our perception that we normally have in three dimensions? And one of them is time. You know, time occurs in a totally different way when you have four dimensions. So a lot of the things that are considered to be, time-like activities in three dimensions don't have to exist in four dimensions. Many things that we think of as having to exist in three dimensions, like gravity, for example, doesn't really have to exist in four dimensions because there's more space. Things have a habit of being able to be turned inside out, and you know, you can walk through a door here and come out of a door over there, and there's apparently no, you know, there's a pathway between those two doors through the fourth dimension, but there's no, so you've instantaneously moved from one place to another place. So you've removed a whole bunch of time-like, there's a whole bunch of motion-based time-like activities that just disappear. The point is that when you get into it, you discover that there's these really, it like you can open up so much more when you realize that things are not as limited as the Michelson-Morley experiment initially led everyone to believe, and which most physicists then and cosmologists then built their careers on for the last 150 years.
Okay. Yeah, well, we'll get back to relativity and the ether. I'm going to organize a very interesting panel on this topic. maybe we'll end up sticking religion in the mix too. I don't know. That could be interesting.
Oh yeah, it's all part of the same deal. It's all, yeah. Well, from my perspective, it's all the one. It's all the same thing. It's not really. They're not really. Yeah, from my perspective, they're not really different things. Mm-hmm. They're the once you sort of, you know, when you're no longer a materialist, the notions of ether become a lot more, or you know, the things that are wrapped up in all of the ideas around ether become a lot more they become a lot more interesting. And so that lack of materialism, or that lack of materialist dogma, for want of a better way of describing it, means that religion has a place again. Mm-hmm. That it otherwise doesn't, you know, there's no place for it really in a materialist paradigm, you know, except as a form of social control or, you know, or some other thing that is kind of, I don't know, a bit, you know, a bit more like political correctness or something like that.
Confucianism.
Confucianism. Yeah.
Okay. So shall we read the Bible?
Oh yes, let me see if I've got. Well, actually,
I can just.
Yeah, I know you've got. You, yeah, yeah. I mean, I've got my copy of the KJV, the NKJV, or whatever it is. But go ahead and read yours, because I think that it's always good to get yours.
Okay, so we'll start with John 1. We did this recently, but we didn't keep it, so now we're going to do it again.
Well, I've still got it, you know, like I've still got that one, and I can, I've still got it. So,
oh, so you want to skip to John 2 then?
Yeah, let's skip to, I would like to skip to John 2 only because.
Yeah. We'll make sure that we post the John 1 stuff as well.
And yeah. Okay.
On to John 2.
Yep. Awesome.
Or at least it's not quite John 2. It's the second page of John. We didn't get that much.
I think we got at least to.
We got to.
Okay, yeah, you're right. We got
the Baptist.
Yeah. I think it's we got up to John 1:18 maybe or 19.
Like that. So we've had the Word embodied and dwelt in us, and we have seen his glory, the glory of the one born Son, who came from the Father filled with grace and truth. And we've had Yohanan testifying about him.
Mm-hmm.
For the law was given through Moshe, but grace and truth came through Yeshua the One.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll go on to, when Yohanan was asked who he was by the priests and the Levites, the Jewish leaders had sent, he did not hide the truth, but freely said, I am not he, not the Messiah. So they asked him, then who are you? Are you Eliyahu? He said, not I. Are you then the prophet? He said, no. Finally, they said, who are you? What should we say to those who sent us? What do you say of yourself? Yohanan quoted Isaiah the prophet, I am a voice calling in the wilderness, prepare the way for the Lord.
Mm.
Now the Pharisees had been sent to question him, said, how can you baptize if you're not the Messiah, nor Eliyahu, nor the prophet? With water I baptize, Yohanan replied, but there stands among you one unknown. He is one that will follow me and that is ahead of me, and I am not even worthy to untie the sandals of his feet. This occurred in Bethania on the far side of the Jordan where Yohanan was baptizing.
Mm-hmm.
First question I have is about baptizing.
Mm.
So we have a concept of baptizing that comes from this whole Christian tradition of baptism. But what was the concept at the time?
Yeah, good question.
I know that it would be related to the Jewish mikveh practice.
Well, what's that?
Which is a cleansing bath. They make a. It can either be done in natural waters, like a lake or in a stream, mm-hmm. or even in the sea, I believe. Or they create a sacred pool that they keep at kind of room temperature, and they say prayers over and cleanse in a particular way.
Right, got it.
And you or sometimes your cooking equipment get cleansed of energies through going into this bath.
Mm-hmm.
It's used a lot more by women than by men, but then there are times when men use it. It's a cleansing of spiritual energies, not specifically of sins in the sense that we talk about it in the Christian tradition, but of but cleansing of a type.
Yeah, interesting. Well, the Mandaeans also practice something very similar to the mikvah. And they declare themselves to be from Yohanan. Their prophet or their original leader was Yohanan, and they don't like the person they call him the liar who came afterwards.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know who the liar is. So some people say it's Jesus, and some people say it's Paul, and some people, and some people say it's it's somebody else in the Jewish, it might be Simon or Judas or one of these Jewish leaders of the time, because these particular Jews of this time, according to the Mandaeans, worshipped the planets, and the candelabra, menorah, is supposed to be a as far as the Mandaeans are concerned, a depiction of the planets, and so they
the seven planets.
And so they have this idea that the Jews were misled by the liar who led them into error, and one of the ways that it happened was they they had too much reliance on the planets, and they worshipped the planets instead of worshipping God. So that was the, you know, and then, and that led, and according to them, that's what leads to the destruction of Israel, you know, of Judea, basically. Yeah, I mean, that at least that's one of the traditions in the, that's one of the Mandean traditions. Now, I don't know whether it's true or not. And I mean, they escaped. Apparently they ran away around about the, you know, shortly after, sometime in the first century.
Mm-hmm.
So sometime in the first century, they left and they headed east.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they ended up in Persia, basically, and in Iraq and a few other places even further east. So they kept on going east. And they did survive quite well for a long time under the Islamic, you know, in the Islamic world in the later periods. But eventually the Nazareans, who were their priest class, were massacred by there was some sort of conflict or some sort of war, and some people took advantage of that to go ahead and kill all the Nazareans. So and of course Nazareans, from their perspective, are the ones set apart, you know, they're of the branch, and they are also set apart. I suppose that's the way branches are. Branches tend to be set apart from the main trunk of the tree. So presumably they also took Nazirite vows, as well as being called Nazareans. Anyway, they've tried, you know, in the 20th century they sort of have tried to reconstruct the Mandean thing, but I don't know how successful they've really been. They have some of their old books, but they don't. A lot of the stuff is, you know, it was by, you know, it was sort of, you know, laying out of hands and that sort of thing. So I don't know how much of that is really, you know, that initiatory part has survived. Now, going back to, they're the real baptizers. So, you know, for them, the reason why I bring them up is because they're the ones who, everything is about baptism, you know. Yeah. And if you go beyond, you know, baptism, then, you know, you're in a realm that you really need to be, you know, careful of, and that realm is really for the ones who are set apart. So the ordinary Mandians don't involve themselves in anything beyond baptism, but they can do baptism no problem.
Mm-hmm.
So they have this idea that, you know, they can do baptism. Baptism's good, no problem. But anything else is really is the province of the priests, the ones who wear a crown. That's one of the ways they talk about their priests. Sorry, the ones who own a crown. And
we're talking about halos here.
I think so, because it's not I don't think they mean a physical crown. It is a physical crown, but I don't think they mean a physical crown, like when a crown you can touch, a crown you can take off somebody.
What is baptism now?
Okay, so I want to. This baptism is a bit of a mystery. I mean, like, you know, what it is now versus what it used to be.
Or what it should be.
So it's gone through a few different versions of itself. So one of the versions that it's gone through is the original baptism is practiced in the Syriac churches was a baptism that really had more in common with a coronation than with the normal baptism that you would have today. So I don't know if you know anything about baptism today, but basically what happens is that whether you do full immersion or you do or you just pour water over the crown of the person, there is oil applied after the baptism. And in this, I think, you know, there's a few little crosses that kind of get made on the, you know, on the forehead and the the neck, and that's, and I think the heart, you know, there's a few different places that you get crossed with oil, chest and so on. So the thing about that is that was not how it was originally done. The baptism of the Syriac church, which is, you know, the earliest version of Christianity, involved the pouring of oil onto the head, onto the crown. And they used a lot of oil, and they used, my understanding is they used chrism, I think they used chrism. So the baptism as it was done back in the original Syriac church had more in common with a coronation or consecration ceremony, like the consecration of a bishop, where the head is completely covered in oil. And
but is this difference important?
Yeah, it's pretty important, because the oil was more, in the original baptism, the oil was more important than the water. The water was almost like a secondary thing that wasn't that, it wasn't all that important by comparison to the oil. The oil was a really big deal, and the water you could almost leave out. I mean, you know, you didn't leave the water out, but it was nowhere near as important as the oil. And the oil is a conduit for the spirit, whereas, you know, the fire of the spirit, I should really say, whereas water is more of a conduit for the more watery versions of the spirit. And so they're different, you know, they have a different quality to them. One is more fire-like and the other one is more, you know, water-like.
I think in a kind of more obvious way of looking at it for people who are not familiar with this symbolism, we use the water for cleansing, for cleaning off the dirt and the impurities. We use the oil to bring in the light, to light the lamps. So we're cleansing out the impurities, and then we're bringing in the positivity. Yeah. That sound right?
About it is that they talk about it as a purifying fire. They talked about it as a they talked about it as the it's fire. Forget the word they use, but it's almost like fire that tempers and also rarefies. That's right, rarefying fire. So the oil was supposed to be something to do with changing you, you know, so that you have this sort of this natural cleansing, as it were, from the water, which I totally agree with, you know, your characterization of it as being a sort of a cleansing thing. And then that's followed by this refining. This refining process that's done with the fire, that although in theory at least, the cleansing was done after the you know, you do the refining fire bit before you do the cleansing. So I don't know, it's a bit strange.
Well, so, maybe you have to and maybe it's like soap, you know, you have to loosen off some bits before they can be washed away.
Yeah, maybe that's, yeah, that may be what it is. Maybe that's the idea, is that the refining fire, that could be it. And so you come out of it both refined and cleansed. And I believe that so that's the original form of baptism as written in the Syriac documents dating back to at least back to around about 300. I think as early as the early 200s, in fact, is where you get some of these documents that date all the way back to the early 200s. Don't really know about anything before that, but you know, there wasn't much change.
And so now today, if you perform a baptism, what do you feel is going on the inside?
Well, it's sort of been paired right back to something that's, to be honest with you, lost a lot of its power. You know, it's still something, and something still happens, but it's more like there's a cleansing and a kind of a, and I think really a connection. So it's become more something that is to do with connecting you up with the Christ impulse, for want of a better. Cool. So the oil is applied, you know, at the end, I guess, to keep you connected, something like that. So that you don't have this, it doesn't have the same kind of cleansing quality that, you know, of tremendous, you know, that had a really tremendous power to it. It's got more of a very sort of light cleanse followed by a connecting you up thing. I think that the application of oil at the end is more like hooking up the telephone lines so that you can be sort of in communication, so that when you go ahead and engage in, say, communion, when, you know, after you're fully baptized, you've taken the vows of baptism, the communion has more of an effect. Whereas I think that for people that would, you know, if people just take the communion and they haven't been baptized, it's not going to have as much of an effect. It'll have an effect, but it won't be the same sort of level of effect. I think a lot of this stuff was a type of spiritual etheric technology that was used, and I think it changed over time because the needs of the people involved and their not just the needs but the means of the people involved changed over time. So I mean, one of the things that a lot of people don't realize, for example, is that the mitre, with the bishop's mitre, which is that, you know, funny fish-shaped hat, that only came into existence in, I think, the 11th or 12th century, something like that. The monstrance, which is that funny star-shaped thing that holds the host. If you want to move the host around the church, you put it in this thing called the monstrance. And that only dates back to like the 13th or 14th century. So there's a lot of things that are quite late additions, and yet they are meaningful, and they have, you know, they're on the money, as in they do exactly what they're supposed to do. Even though they are very late. So obviously,
even later on in the church, there were people who knew what they were doing.
Yes, that's my point. Yes, that's exactly my point.
The Gregorian chant that we love so much today is, well, you know, it's fairly late invention. That's beautiful, because obviously some people were connected up. They knew what they were singing about.
I mean, if you look at a guy like St. John of the Cross, who's like, I think he's 16th century, and his stuff is, he's a sort of a reformed Carmelite. and as opposed to the unreformed, rather corrupt Carmelites that, mm-hmm. that he was, that they had a big conflict with. He's really, like, it was more like they had a conflict with the reformed people. The reformed people were actually very loving and mm-hmm. stuff. He's really, his stuff rings true, really, really true. His poetry and his philosophy and he knows how you connect yourself to the one God. He knows how you do it. And his work has no, it has no sense in it of, there's no disparagement of anyone, or there's no feeling of, having it in for anyone, even though yeah. he was treated really badly by some of these other people, including people in his own order, as in the reformed order. I won't go into the details, yeah. but it's an interesting history. Once you discover that the church has had, the Roman church, it's crazy to think of it, because we tend to think of the Roman church as being a bit sort of, stultified, stuck in its mm-hmm. ways, kind of stuck in concrete, not really, mm-hmm. not really. And I think it has become like that, but there have been lots of times in history where there's really been a flourishing of spirituality and a flourishing of people who really knew what they were doing, at different times. And they have provided us with all sorts of effectively spiritual technology we could use. And we have used. I mean, I imagine there's some that has been lost to us because we've
mm-hmm.
We've kind of lost it. It didn't take, or nobody understood how it worked, or it was.
We still need to get back to understanding the inner process that somebody goes through and why they might want to do baptism. And
absolutely,
and absolutely. How it's
done.
And also the connect similarity between the Diksha process of the East.
What's the
process? The initiation process that's used by yogis, which is, the ritual is very different, but the inner spirit of it is quite similar, I believe.
Oh, okay. Well, you have
so to. So we'll have to get into that as well.
Yeah, because I don't know anything about that. That's really interesting. I've come across the idea of Eastern initiation, Eastern yogis initiating people, but I've never. I don't know much about it, except that I know what happens.
Okay, cool. So we've got plenty more to
explore. Yeah,
I think.
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay. Speak soon.
Okay, talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.